The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
What's up, guys? Welcome to the first ever episode 41 of the Kinda Funny Games cast. As always, I'm Tim Geddes, joined by the coolest dudes in video games, Colin Moriarty and Greg Miller.
Hello.
Got a fuzz on my shirt. Got it, though.
Fuzz happens, man. Now, a lot of people have been like telling me, hey, Tim, you can make the games cast better if you get guests. And I was like, all right, I'm going to do that. Get motherfucking Adam Sessler here.
Oh,
deal with it. You don't get much better than that.
That's very kind.
So we're going to be talking about video games for the next hour or so. Uh-huh. And I'm very excited about that. We got a great show planned today. And for those of you that do not know, this is a show that every week we just talk about video games for about an hour. And it's great. But today we're doing it with Adam Sessler. You want to get this show. What?
And yeah, with Adam Sessler and your shoes match your shirt.
My shoes do match my shirt.
Bring it up. Bring it up. There it is. Look at that. Wow. Look at this coordination.
These are old loves for those that know out there.
It looks like old Pittsburgh Penguins colors from the late 80s, early 90s.
I was thinking Steelers, so
Is that like the one outfit where that works, though?
It is. It's a long story. I got the shirt. Shout out to Cunning Linguist and Tone Deaf for hooking me up with the shirt. The Thugged Out Since Cub Scout shirt, which I love.
That's cute.
So much. It describes me in such a beautiful way. I've had these shoes for a long time. They're beautiful. But I don't get to wear them too often.
Yeah.
They're pretty loud.
I got Slimer pizza shoes out there I've never worn. I'm still waiting for the shirt that goes with those.
And you got your Capri Sun shoes as well.
Those are a work of art. My hashtag pouch up because of Capri Sun shoes.
I'll never forget when you got that when we were at IGN. I'm like, what?
Yeah, wait. Can we see them?
No, they can't see them. They're over there. I mean, we can see them.
If you put them in the freezer, do they become a popsicle?
Sadly,
that would be badass.
But anyways, I'm very thrilled about how this outfit looks.
I'm very
happy about it. It reminds me of an older time, like a couple of years ago, back when I was younger, which is weird of how that works.
Yeah.
But this is how I used to dress in high school all the time. So I'm happy that I can, you know, bring it back for a new generation of kids, the teens out there. They need to look up to something. I hope that it's me. So this show, every week we talk about video games. You should go to iTunes.com/kindoffunny. Rate, comment, subscribe, do all that stuff. It'll help make us feel really happy about everything so we can keep doing this, keep getting awesome guests like Adam Sessler to talk about stuff. The first topic of the day is horror games.
Ooh.
What makes a good horror game? Now, this is spurred by a little something special, some project that you're working on.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about this.
So I have the pleasure of getting to work with, it's a small team right now. It's a mixture of Gun Media and another group called Illphonic. And they were, once upon a time, it was already announced, working on a game called Slasher Volume 1 Summer Camp. It was an homage to 1980s slasher flicks. You can probably imagine it. It's asymmetric multiplayer. One person plays the killer. Seven people play counselors. The point is for the killer to kill all the counselors and for the counselors to escape or make it through the night or possibly kill the guy who's hunting them.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, this game implied certain famous movie franchises like Friday the 13th without actually being Friday the 13th. But the guy's actually gone so far as to enlist the help of Tom Savini, the very famous makeup artist who worked on both Friday the 13th Part 1 and 4, and he's very famous for the original Dawn of the Dead. The guy is just a genius. So he's coming on to help design the kills. And what's really cool is to help design the kills to make sure that they could still exist as a practical effect inside of a movie. Not take advantage of, you know, what you can play with physics and video games, but to really give it that sense of being grounded. They also were working with Kane Hodder, who played Jason in 7, 8, and 9. Mm. May not be the best movies, but his representation of Jason is the one that I think stands the test of time.
Spot on.
And is what is in everyone's memory. He was going to be doing the mocap. So because of their participation, word got to a gentleman named Sean S. Cunningham, who directed the first Friday the 13th and is the man who owns the license to the franchise. He heard about this, and he's like, well, I've been waiting for a game, a good game, to give the Friday the 13th a license to, and he gave it to them, gratis.
That's crazy.
Yeah. So now, the game they were always implying, the franchise they were implying with the game, now gets to be that game. That's why they've gone back to Kickstarter, because while they were funded sufficiently to make Summer Camp, the requirements, you know, now with the accuracy, recreating Crystal Lake, making Jason's, actually, and all of that, that is going to require more money. And mm-hmm. so we're going out asking for people to donate, or at the very least, you know, I'm here to say, hey, if you have $2, $5, $10, that actually can make a huge, huge difference. Mm-hmm. Additionally, if you can't do that, I understand. If you want to just kind of signal boost and get the word out.
Just tell people about it.
But this is...
like this link.
Right here.
Yeah.
Go to it. And then in description, you can click over to the Kickstarter itself.
But when I was told about this game, and I've loved horror movies all my life. It's actually why I married my wife. We both loved an academic text called Men, Women, and Chainsaws, which is just a... you know,
once you heard that, you're great, like, wow, you know, we got to be together.
Examination of horror movies. But this, because not just because of asymmetric, because it kind of it plays up to that dream of when you're watching the movies and you're seeing what you think are dumb decisions being sure. made. And it's like, you know, you get to go in there and you get to, you know, I've in looking at the game and talking with them, those dumb decisions may happen more frequently where it's like, okay, we want to get the parts for the car because we want to get out of here. Let's split up. You know, the fundamental bad idea in every single horror movie. And I love the other aspect where it is asymmetric, but say, as opposed to something like Evolve or Spies versus Mercs, the goal is not for there to eventually be conflict. Mm-hmm. If you are the counselors, it might be in your best interest never to see Jason through the course of the game. Maybe you just join up with one other person and try to work together. You know, maybe you don't want to join up with all seven counselors because you're all in the same place. So if mm-hmm. he shows up, you know,
it's over, game over.
It's fish in a barrel. You play various archetypes. You know, the jock. There's the girl who's a little bit edgy. You know, you can imagine all that. Mm-hmm. They'll have various skills. So there is, you know, an encouragement. You might want to work with one or two people. Obviously, some will be faster than others. So while it is kind of 1v7, it's really 1v1v1v1v1. Because the only thing that you want to do is you want to make it through the night. Not everyone has to make it through the night. You do. So you could work in concert with someone for a little bit, and then Jason shows up and you can run faster. Okay, then, yeah, by the laws of the jungle.
Yeah.
You know, if you guys work on the boat, that's great. Except the boat only carries two people. So what if you have three people who are all trying to work on getting it? So there's a wonderful sense of both teamwork and treachery and that wonderful sort of tension, you know, really kind of captures, I think, the spirit of what those movies always wanted to do, which is you feel helpless, you know, against this highly overpowered enemy, and whether or not you sort of have the wherewithal and how clever you are to make it through the evening.
Mm-hmm. So is it like permadeath? If Jason gets you and kills you, you're out of that match. You're out of that match.
Okay, yes. And then you'll get to watch what happens to everyone else. You know, you can scream all you want and they can't hear you, just like in the movie.
Don't go there. What is the nature of, so it's, you know, taking place, Friday the 13th is near and dear to my heart. I actually really, really love that series. Super iconic. I think that out of, I think of like a trilogy of iconic 80s style, maybe late 70s, like Halloween. And then you have Nightmare on Elm Street and Friday the 13th. And Jason always spoke to me. I always thought that was the creepiest one. What I always talk about is that I always loved as a kid and still do, like when I look at it, the way that movie looks during the daytime, the juxtaposition of like the trees being green and the blue sky or whatever, and how that seems so beautiful and welcoming, and then how harrowing that same scenario becomes when it's dark. I just think it's like very simple and very forthcoming, and I like that. So since this is going to take place at Crystal Lake, what are the maps? Is it one map, or are there like many different sections of it?
This is interesting, and here's one thing I had never really considered. Episode 1 through 4, that takes place over a period of 3 weeks. You know, Jason doesn't really stop. It's not like he rests for a year and decides to reemerge. No, he's on a killing spree. So that should give you a sense of there's a lot more geography. We all think of the camp. That's where it starts. But there are other locations. It's a lake and people have summer homes and stuff like that there. So all of that is going to be incorporated. So in essence, there's one map. And initially when they're working on it, they had a very, very big map and it was just too big. You know, the length of time for Jason to finally encounter you, it was taking too long.
Counselors are hiding in one corner forever.
So now it's in essence one map, but it will be somewhat randomized. So, you know, you're going to have elements like a barn, you know, the stuff you've seen in the movies. So you won't be playing the exact same map every time, but you are playing at Crystal Lake every time.
And are you playing as any of the kids from the movies, or are these going to be like the...
Because of licensing issues, they cannot replicate those because those are actors.
Right.
I mean, you know, Kevin Bacon was in the first one. but you are playing, I think you should expect to play familiar characters to what you know from the movies.
The archetypes, right?
Cool. It sounds
and also, you're not just playing as one Jason. there will be multiple Jasons because
based on the different movie iterations.
If you look at the movies, and I've watched all of them back to back, that is a fascinating tour of the 1980s style and value system. But, you know, you have the bag over the head for two.
Mm. Yeah.
You obviously have someone very different in one. You know, then Hockey Mask emerges in three, but then you have Coming Back from the Dead in six, and then I've Been Underwater Getting Really Rotten from 7 through 9. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, they're going to be showing variants of Jason. The only two that they've committed to right now is three, which is called Big Neck, because they had put a prosthetic there on the back of his neck to kind of give it a sense of bone there. And obviously the very famous Kane Hodder version that is 7 through 9.
I want the metal mask.
What is the nature? Is the, do you guys have, I don't know if you have to figure this out in the future, like a price point? Is this a retail game or a downloadable game? Like, what can people expect in terms of this, like, delivery?
Right now, the determination is, you know, PC, Xbox One, PS4. I think it's fair to assume that retail would be the goal with this. I don't want to fully commit on that right now because you just caught me off guard.
Sorry, I'm trying to imagine in my head, like, is it a $20 game? Is it a $40 game? Is it a $60 game? Like, even though those don't really mean anything, but they kind of do in a sense. It gives you an idea. Fair.
They do. Yeah. They do. You know, that's a, I need to give you an honest answer. We're in the middle of the Kickstarter right now, and that might be putting that cart well in front of that horse. Mm-hmm. And I think the success of the Kickstarter will determine a lot of those matters
for
sure.
Mm. Like many Kickstarters. I mean, right now the Kickstarter, last we looked, it just crossed 150,000.
Yes,
as of recording, so it started today.
Right now.
So I mean, which is very, very exciting. Uh-huh. Obviously, we're aiming for 700,000, which is a lot of money. Mm-hmm. But that really has been well thought out about what is necessary to get all of those art assets in. And also, they feel that, you know, if you go look at the Kickstarter page, I mean, they're very, very honest that they don't want to mess this up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, they want to make gamers happy, but they also have, like, hardcore fans of Friday the 13th. And there's even one kid this morning who, when he saw, you know, the art for the announcement, he knew exactly that was, you know, Friday the 13th Part 3, that because of the state of the hockey mask, it had to be from that movie.
Yeah.
They are planning to give that level of attention to detail to really serve that fan base, and that just does cost more money.
And I mean, that's what's exciting, though, is the getting it right aspects about it. Exactly. And just hearing you talk about, like, knowing the differences between all the different Jasons, and there's different levels, obviously, of Friday the 13th fans, where there's the people that are like, oh man, like, I love those movies and whatever. And then there's the guys that are like, I love those movies. It's, and this needs to kind of make both those teams kind of happen.
And I think so. I think there's some people that may not understand the level of detail, but what it is offering in terms of a gameplay experience, I think really is unique. And I think, I mean, the guys who are already playing it, obviously it's all being prototyped right now.
They're working
first on the gameplay, and then, you know, art will go on top of that, is it's already pretty scary. That, you know, you already have that sense that there's something out there. Because unlike the movies, you know, because you're playing the game, you know there's something bad out there. If you go look at the movies, you know, full awareness that there's someone killing everyone doesn't happen until about the last reel. You know, that's why people are like, hey, let's take our clothes off. Because they don't know there's a killer out there. Mm. That's why they're taking their clothes off. And so that changes the dynamic a little bit. Where you're planning, you know, you want to get out of there, you want to be quiet as possible, you don't want to, you know, sort of draw the attention of Jason, but you know that there's that threat, and that threat is player controlled.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it has caused enough scares. I think the huge difference of having Jason rather than an invented enemy is twofold. A, that hockey mask is so damn iconic. It's just, we know what that is supposed to mean. Mm-hmm. Also, from just an art standpoint, And you can see it in the movies. It's so white that you have this thing that you can see
in the dark,
even from a distance, that will start to say, oh, we are in trouble.
Mm.
That, you know, oh, we're also using the help of Harry Manfredini. Haha, I pronounced it. He created the music.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah.
And that will be in the game.
Fuck yeah.
How it will be incorporated, we don't know yet. And he's also going to be designing other music for the game. So you're going to have all of these fun elements that are playing upon both a sense of memory and sort of a sense of fun inside the game to just kind of get that anxiety going. This is the one game ever my wife has said she wants to play.
Wow.
So I know there's something right that's happening.
Good. I mean,
it sounds awesome. It sounds like you're hitting on everything you'd want from this kind of game, and definitely from a Friday the 13th, you know, fans' perspective.
Yeah.
Seeing the trailer, it, like, you know, you hear the VO from the mom and stuff. Do you think there will be, like, story elements to this, or is it just multiplayer?
The core of the game is asymmetric multiplayer. The ultimate stretch goal would be the inclusion of some single player elements.
Nice.
I wouldn't, campaign. I'm not going to say campaign. I think it's more going to be stuff that's going to sort of test you out. To really appreciate it though, we need to have that much money to do it, because to program the AI for Jason, I mean, that's very unique AI, because he has to have almost like superhuman awareness. But he has to move in a particular way, and obviously he has to come across as believable. I mean, there's a lot of complexity in trying to make an enemy that you might think is kind of more rudimentary and dumb.
On that note, is there, looking at other asymmetric experiences like Evolve, people had a lot of concerns by that. I know that Sony's working on Killstrain now, and we have some other examples of this. Is there a concern, any sort of concern, that without single player functionality, that the game will live or die based on the amount of people that play it, and therefore... You know, like, it seems like, in other words, it seems like people like seem to have more of a problem with multiplayer games being only multiplayer.
Yeah, no, and I see what you're saying. And the reason why I feel confident that this would distinguish itself from it is this isn't skill-based in the same way. Mm. Dying in this game should prove just as entertaining as succeeding. Mm. You know, remember, you know, if you die, you will see one of many, many creative inventions that Tom Savini came up with. Also, it's... When you play a lot of multiplayer, even like asymmetric or otherwise, you know, depending upon what other people are doing, it can become very frustrating. You can just keep on getting stomped on. And there's that certain need, like, okay, I'm going to have to play four or five matches in a given evening to kind of get that experience where I feel like I've had enough. The more I think about playing this game and that it violates a lot of the rules of what you're supposed to do in a multiplayer experience, you're trying to avoid people, except for one character is the only one. You're playing hide and go seek, really. And... That allows for, you could have, I think the reliability of a satisfying experience, you know, and if something goofy happens between one of you, like if one of your friends isn't that great, they will cause added new tension because, you know, they don't know how to carry the part or they can't suddenly be fixing the car. It's like, no, come on. It's a very different type of experience than what you would normally associate with multiplayer. And yes, as you play the game, you're going to have skills that carry over and you'll be able to improve the characters that you're playing. But the real fun, I think, is just in that instance. I think it'll be very, very fun with friends. And I think especially as people get known for playing Jason really, really well, I mean, it can become like, hey, let's see if we can get this guy and see if he can scare the absolute crap out of us and we can like somehow make it out from under him.
On a surface level, it strikes me as going into the direction of what I liked about Left 4 Dead versus Evolve, right? Left 4 Dead was like, oh, cool, just jump in. We all kind of, there's differences to our characters and our loadouts or whatever, but they're all basically the same. So you can get down to actually, how are we getting over the problem at hand right now?
Right.
Whereas Evolve was, I'm a trapper and I'm going to put down the dome and do this and do, and do you know how to interact? And they're like, that's complicated. And that's, you need a team to roll with. Whereas you could jump into.
Left 4 Dead, and I think you're right, is all four players needed to kind of be firing on all pistons and working in concert with one another. And here you could, you know, you could be on some part of the map and like never see another counselor and just say, I'm just gonna go it alone and see if I can go really quiet and try to get over there, or maybe try to hide in one place. It's highly inadvisable to hide in one place. There are aspects, because Jason will have certain skills.
I'm assuming he has some kind of vision or some kind of ping ability.
Because if you're hiding
do.
Underneath the bed, well, you can't ask the person playing Jason to be like,
look under, the bed.
Yeah. He knows you're under the bed and he puts a knife through it. And so through that kind of skill that he has, the longer you stay in one place, the easier he will be able to sense that you are there. So it will be in your best interest to try to move around and see, you know, and not just be sitting around. We have to keep people moving through the map.
Yeah. Right.
So, what interests me a lot about this is like being able to balance the you know, the kind of supernatural, super badass guy that can kill anybody as soon as he sees them, but then also kind of making sure that the counselors, that the ones that the other people are playing as, don't feel video game overpowered. You know, because like in video games, you instantly kind of have the sense of like, I can run fast and jump and do all this crazy stuff. But like, how are you guys making, or how are they making sure that the characters aren't overpowered in a video game sense, but also aren't too underpowered that they can't do anything?
Right. No, and this is, you know, this is stuff that they're working on right now. I mean, because unlike even other asymmetric games where there still is some sort of sense of balance, albeit very, very different, Jason is supposed to be overpowered. Yes, you can kill him, but it is going to be extraordinarily hard. And the amount of risk you're probably going to take on, because you're probably going to have to do it with a lot of other people. Like, that is, that is your bird in the hand. I mean, you're going for the bush. So you want to have them overpowered to have that, but the counselors will have skill sets. You know, we are going to have the girl next door. We're very aware of kind of what the stereotypes are. They don't want to talk too much about those specifically because that is what is being worked on.
Sure.
But there are certain edges that you will have that will help guide your decision making when you're playing that particular character.
Well, what are some examples of that? Like, even not specifics, but just like what could you earlier you mentioned.
Let's say that there's someone who, you know, probably one of the male characters with a pair of glasses is going to be a little bit better at mechanics. So if there's a car, but you need to get the car parts. So people are going to get the car parts. If he's the one who's actually fixing the car, you're just going to be able to do that much more quickly. So something, you know, of that nature. A jock would probably be stronger, so he could handle some melee attacks. So if Jason does appear, you know, he might be able to sort of push him back a little bit so everyone has a chance to run. There's going to be a handful of stat categories. And so some characters will be obviously superior in some versus others. Obviously, no one wants to go into the specifics of what the stats are because that's what we're figuring out.
And I assume you've talked about, you know, fixing the car or the boat has two seats and all that, but you're fixing the boat and stuff. I'm assuming that to kill Jason, is it basically like a mousetrap kind of puzzle where it's like we all are like, we're doing this. So you set up this part and you do this and then we all run.
That is still indecision. Yeah. And I've even chatted a little bit about, I mean, that is one of the biggest decisions to make because A, it has to be believable. B, it has to really respect that, you know, this is not, it doesn't really get accomplished in the movie. So it has to be something that, you know, it makes sense and it asks enough of the player. Mm-hmm. I know that there's a few ideas that they're kicking around. I mean, these are the discussions I cannot wait to start having with the team.
I can only imagine.
Once you get through this Kickstarter.
It sounds cool. I don't play multiplayer games very much, mostly because I don't like to have to stick with a game and progress to something. So this, I mean, honest to God, and it's not just because you're here, we're talking about it. This sounds like a little more intriguing in a game.
Well, because you could jump in and ignore everybody.
The other thing is, I think this is going to be the kind of multiplayer game that is for adults with normal schedules. That, you know, you can play 5 matches in an evening. You'll probably have a great time. You can also, you know, if you can get your friends together all at one time, have one match. And it's still something you're going to want to be talking about because there will be events and we'll have that kind of just sort of organic way of the fun emerging and you're trying to work together and probably there's someone screwing up. I mean, I think one of the things I always struggled is, you know, to tell a narrative inside of a multiplayer game. That usually in Call of Duty, there's just so much going on. It's like people playing basketball, but, you know, there's one ball for every two people. So it's just chaos. Here, there really is a sense of a beginning, some type of middle, and some type of end, or maybe multiple ends is all the counselors.
Inevitably get to die.
It sounds cool. Yeah. I think it sounds really cool.
It's cool. I mean, in a lot of ways, it sounds like Until Dawn, but just with multiplayer. And I feel like that this is a really cool way to take on that. And, I'm in the same boat as you where I'm very intrigued to be able to play a multiplayer game just in little slices and just be like, that was a cool experience. I can either do it again or not.
Yeah, because you don't have to worry about progression and skill level and matchmaking. And
or a bunch of 12-year-olds who are developing their skill set at this game at a rate far faster than you are because that's all they're devoting their time to.
Right, exactly. That's a huge turnoff to me for multiplayer games. So this sounds
I mean, that's exactly how I feel about multiplayer games. I play them very infrequently. Also, I hate the sense of, in co-op sometimes, that burden. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't want to be like the rock for you have to carry up the hill.
Yep.
Once again, I just think this answers for a ton of those issues and that it can appeal to both a casual and an experienced gamer because it's offering something that doesn't have a very easy corollary.
Yeah.
With that said, will there be some sort of, I don't want to call it a progression system, but some sort of experience system that will reward you with aesthetic things or things that don't really affect the gameplay, but like
No. You may be able to, there will be something to progress throughout it. And I'm not going to go so far as to say it may only be it. Aesthetic. I mean, there is an attention to the sense that, you know, you should be rewarded if you want to stick with it. But once again, it's not competitive in a normal way. So if someone is more advanced than you,
it doesn't really affect.
That doesn't really
if
affect.
If a jock runs faster.
Okay, I understand. No, interesting. Sounds good.
Yeah, it sounds really great. If you guys are interested, which you definitely should be, head to the link below. You see it right here. Kickstarter for Friday the 13th, the game. Yes. It looks awesome. Check out the trailer. It's at 150 now. I'm really interested to see where it's at. People tweet at me. when you see this episode, let me know where it's at when after this is over.
Cool. Everything's looking up. Oh. He's writing down the time code.
Oh, okay.
Kevin had to go get his car fixed, so I'm looking over here at the clock every so often.
Yeah, I like that a lot. So, guys, the second topic of the day is Game of the Year so far. We've done this topic twice before on the Games Cast. pretty much once per quarter. In the first round, we talked a lot about Dying Light because it was pretty early. There wasn't too much going on.
Yeah, very
then
early.
Eventually there was a bit more talk about Arkham Knight and
Witcher.
So now we're going to open this again with Adam, our good friend.
Ah.
Mm-hmm.
What do you bring to the table?
And I thought I had escaped this game. Yeah,
we'd also like you to rate everything out of 5.
Yeah.
I mean, I think on the whole, as of now, Witcher stands out the most to me. I mean, it is interesting, to be honest. As it is kind of nice over the past year and some change that when I'm playing a game, I'm not just judging it against all the other games. How you guys are. You're doing it. It's like, okay, just keep the list going. That way I can write that thing up and then just go away for the holidays. But, I mean, Witcher was that thing I was so stupid excited for. And I just fell into it. I'm terribly surprised how much I'm liking Metal Gear Solid 5.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, from a design perspective, that game is almost wicked in how it gets its claws in you.
Yeah.
Yep.
Because the way the rewards just interlock with everything else that you're doing. But it's still really weird.
What's your history with the Witcher series and the Metal Gear series?
I've played all the Witcher games.
Okay.
I have only finished one of the other Metal Gear games, and that was 4.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, it was, I would have loved to have gone back. Was Snake Eater was the Xbox version of 3, correct?
No.
And what was he?
They were all Subsistence.
Subsistence, that's right. So I played Snake Eater, I guess, on the PlayStation 2. And like that lack of compass, where am I going? And it was like, no! And by the time the Xbox version came out, they kind of addressed some of those.
Yeah.
There's so many other games I need to be playing to stay current. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is just one of the flaws.
Oh, we know it well.
Of covering it. In terms of Witcher, I played the first. Matt Kyle, who worked on XPlay, was like, Adam, you've got to play this. This is like your kind of like dark fantasy that with bad consequences. He's like, look, it's written by Polish Jews. I'm like, all right, I'm in. So I did that and then got really excited for Witcher 2 and then obviously Witcher 3. It just I love the combat in 3 and I put up with the combat in 1. So it's been nice to see it progress also.
Nice. Metal Gear for me.
Yeah.
I mean, I had said before, right, I think I was saying in the last time, for a long time it was Witcher, right, that I thought was game of the year. But I kept saying, but I'm waiting on Metal Gear and Fallout. And now it's Metal Gear, but I'm waiting on Fallout.
Yeah, I would not be surprised if a lot of outlets give Metal Gear game of the year. Like that. And that's something that would not surprise me, nor would I say, oh my God, no!
Video game journalism died in 2015.
But what do you feel about like the other contenders, like some of the games you talked about, like Witcher? Do you think, would you be surprised if you saw them writing that up?
I wouldn't be surprised. I think what's going to be interesting is Witcher in the shadow of Fallout. Assuming Fallout is as good as we have every reason to expect it's going to be, they kind of inhabit a more similar space. The Metal Gear, as open world as it is, it's Kojima. It's just that weird animal that is a Kojima game. And so it does have the benefit of kind of standing very distinct from a lot of the other stuff that's coming out this year. I mean, there's a lot of open world this year.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And his version of open world is one of the most bizarre and quite satisfying versions. Mm-hmm.
Colin, where are you?
I mean, since we last talked about this, I guess I'd throw in Rocket League into the conversation. I think that Rocket League is pretty immaculate. And as I said before, I wouldn't be surprised if Rocket League won Game of the Year from some big outlets. That game is just pure fun. People really didn't see that game coming, which I find hilarious because we played it so many times. And as we talked about, like that game had fucking huge written all over it. And people finally got their hands on it. I remember, as we talked about in the past, I remember when we played at PSX last year, I'm like, this is going to be huge. This game's gonna be absolutely massive, and lo and behold, it's massive because
people love it
because it's just fun. It's sold millions of copies. It's probably one of the best selling games of the year.
Mm-hmm.
So good on Psyonix and good for our friend Jeremy Dunham that we used to, you know,
huge Friday the 13th fan too. So he can't lose this year.
I would throw that in there, and then I would throw Mad Max into the mix. I think Mad Max is awesome. We joke around about like my increasing love of it and how we think it's getting better and better, but I don't think it's going to be game of the year, but I still think Dying Light's my favorite game of the year. But I think Mad Max is just a fantastic game. It's a good, as I've talked about, it's just a good game to just check boxes in. Mm-hmm. If that's the way you like to play games, and that's kind of the way I like to play games sometimes, it's a fun game. Go get rid of this scarecrow tower, take over this camp, find this collectible in this fucking stunningly beautiful world with awesome car combat and some kind of Arkham Knight light sort of hand-to-hand combat and stuff like that. I think Mad Max is a great game.
How overloaded with content is it, sort of in comparison to Arkham Knight?
I think it's heavier than Arkham Knight. And if you don't count the Riddler trophies, which are ridiculous, but it's more akin to like a Far Cry or like a Yugi game to me. I would actually compare it most density to Witcher. The thing that turned me off to the Witcher Witcher 3 after 60 or 70 hours was how fucking dense it was. It's not like I just felt like I was getting nowhere in that game. Mm-hmm. Like every question mark would turn into 7 more question marks, which would turn into 15 question marks. And I was like, I can't fucking take it anymore. So I stopped playing that game. That was too much for even me, and I'm kind of a fucking sucker for that stuff. I would say it finds the nice happy medium between Arkham Knight, which I think was better in terms of its presentation and aesthetic and storytelling. I mean, those characters are interesting. Mad Max is more of a UB game where it's like, here's a map, and it's all red, and you're slowly going to take over every section of the map until it's white. You know, and I'm like, okay, that's fun. So I think Mad Max is an overlooked game. I just think it's fun. It's really unique car combat in the game too. That's like quite satisfying. It's cool. There's like trade convoys that you have to like take over, and like there's like 7 cars, and you have to just get aside them and like just fucking shotgun blast the driver to get one car off, and then like stick a harpoon in another car and rip its tire off as you're like speeding around and like shooting, you know, at the other tires. And like it's just, I think it's just really like frenetic and fun. Mm-hmm. I mean, we haven't had this conversation since Until Dawn came out, right? I would throw Until Dawn in there. I think with the exception of Dying Light, Until Dawn might be my favorite game of the year. Mm-hmm. That game just came out of nowhere. And I thought it was going to be good. We've played the game many times at preview events, but I didn't know it was going to be that good. Mm-hmm. And that's what I said before is, and what we've talked about with Supermassive, like Supermassive and Sony didn't expect that it was going to sell this well either. Like people couldn't find the game. Mm-hmm. So I would throw that into the mix as well.
But didn't even like Heavy Rain... Probably not the other one, Beyond. Was that
Beyond, Beyond Souls? Souls, yeah.
But I thought Heavy Rain way outsold expectation.
It did.
That, I mean, yeah, it was funny that it did seem that like Sony was kind of like, yeah, we got that one over there. It's like, you guys have actually shown a fair amount of success with
this type
stuff that shouldn't sell well.
Exactly. Yeah, Heavy Rain did well. I remember I'm sure it's well beyond this point now, but Quantic Dream gave that speech at GDC where they were like, we have like 3 million trophy pings, but only 2 million copies sold. It was like more of a thing of like, buy our game. But they definitely sold millions of copies of Heavy Rain. Heavy Rain's a great game. Heavy Rain's better than Until Dawn. But what I keep saying about Until Dawn, because you bring up Quantic Dream, is that they've out-Quantic-dreamed Quantic Dream in terms of the dynamic.
That's what I keep hearing.
Yeah, in terms of the dynamic of the story, the kind of open nature of it. It's not like locked down and kind of like chapter by chapter, but rather... It is literally like chapter by chapter in a sense, but it's an hour and it takes place every hour.
But it also sounds like what was smart is they picked the right kind of story. Doing the horror story and having it dynamically branch, I think that's more controllable than, as with Heavy Rain, it was a mystery. As much as I liked Heavy Rain, it's like you probably shouldn't have done a mystery, which kind of has like
an answer.
There's one, exactly. Yeah. That's a big one to take on.
Well, that's David Cage. So I'm interested to see, like, I think Quantic Dream's next game is going to be a Paris Games Week, obviously, a PS4 game. And I'm interested to see what they do. And I'm interested to see like what that game's like in comparison to Until Dawn, because they were created concurrently and they're not gonna be able to react to that game. But I do think Supermassive did themselves very proud and they understand what they have with this game and their interviews that they've been giving where they're like, we're doing more of this. And I think not necessarily Until Dawn, although they said they might do it Until Dawn too with different characters, but
I would just be surprised.
But, well, they're going to, and I still feign. It's not even feigning. I exclaim shock to this day that their mock reviews didn't come in, and their marketing department didn't understand that this game was going to be big, and that they had something special here. And I don't understand why they didn't hold it and release it during October. And I also didn't kind of narrow in on that horror, that vibe that we get this month or whatever. I think that's a really special game. So I would throw in Mad Max, Rocket League, and Until Dawn as games that I think are going to be in contention. Mm-hmm. For you know, game of the year. I don't think any of them will necessarily win, but I think that they're
going to be in that discussion
worth
chattering about. Cut out eventually.
Well, because the old talk used to go, even when we were at IGN, is like we would nominate games or people would nominate games and then be like, well, I don't think this game necessarily would win. And then the argument's like, well, why would we nominate it at all? Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I understand that argument, but I also understand we want to build a list of the best games.
Yeah, exactly.
And so I would put them on.
Yeah. One of my biggest issues with game of the year was, you know, obviously it's a collective decision and sometimes the anxiety is more like, hold on, this is going to define us for the next year. It's like, well, look, somewhat, and a lot of people are going to be pissed off no matter what you do, but I'm so much more interested in trying to give praise to games that people might not know are worthy of that. I mean, yeah. That's what I do with like best movies of the year. If I'm reading the New York Times or something like that, I go through. I'm like, I haven't heard of this. I will now go look for this. That's it should be about the discoverability, not about the
championing and fighting.
Right. Look at my wisdom for finding greatness over there.
Yeah. It's interesting you bring up Rocket League and Until Dawn, because I think those are two games that really kind of were enhanced by the whole streamer culture that is happening.
Oh,
now,
sure, yeah.
Where like those games are to this day super popular on Twitch and YouTube and all this stuff. And I think that it's really cool to see, quote unquote, smaller games getting that type of exposure. And it's like those games come up on my Twitter every single day. Somehow, some different people are talking about it. And I think that's...
Well, no one stopped talking about Rocket League. Yeah.
Ever. You know, it's just like, it just never stopped. And like the Until Dawn, I think is the gift that keeps on giving, where it's like, people are like, oh no, it's actually good. You should play it. And then someone's like, all right, I will eventually. And then they play it like, holy shit, this is fucking good. You should play it. It just
and
keeps
that thing of like, people will stop in to see people's streams to see, oh, did you get caught up the same death that I got caught up on? Who survived for you? Who do you hate that I didn't? It's weird.
Think about what could have happened with Mass Effect. I think the Mass Effect 3 ending controversy, had we had a service like Twitch. I've always said, I think one of the biggest problems that people didn't understand that entire game was an ending.
Yeah, of course.
You know, and that they did almost too good a job at, because it was impossible to tell, okay, what is, because I did it, and what is it, was already predetermined by the game. It was only after a discussion I had with people, I'm like, oh my God, there was so much more that was dynamic in that game.
Yeah.
And I think, that really, would have helped that game quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously for me, my answer is definitely Metal Gear. Having not played too much of those other games, just because they're not for me, Metal Gear is the one, and I've said this a million times, but I love the Metal Gear franchise, but 5 scared me because of the open world stuff. And everything you guys said, it's like, it hooked me, and it's not that open world. It really is kind of, it's a small
two maps
open world.
Open world, but it delivers on something that a lot of open world games don't, which is do it how you want.
Mm-hmm.
And... getting the new equipment, I think in a lot of open world games, and as much as I love Far Cry, I know I would do this in Far Cry. You just start leaning on the one way that you go about doing stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And this, it really is like, hold on, I have something. It actually is useful. It's fun for me to figure out how to sort of manipulate that tool or that weapon to take care of the guards, and the fact that the guards are responding, that the bad guys are putting on the helmets or they're putting on the night vision goggles.
Yep.
It's forcing you to actually think in a more strategic and creative way. That is so damn impressive to me.
The biggest compliment I can give the game is how it's constantly teaching me new things to do, and I want to. And it's like when you don't get everything at once. It slowly kind of unlocks the ability to customize your helicopter or to go on side ops or to, be able to see what level the random people are to Fulton them. And it's just like, it feels so rewarding. It constantly is rewarding to me, even though the gameplay is very repetitive when you boil it down.
When you go out on a mission, it's always the same, one of the same four or five things, right? Yep. Of getting this guy or getting
save this guy, kill this guy, get this thing, watch this, whatever weird ass hologram thing.
To Colin's point, and I just agree with you 100%, even in Witcher 3, as much as I liked it, gating is becoming such a problem in games where it's like, stop like playing 52 pickup with the player where it's like, oh, here's everything. I mean, look, one of my biggest issues with Batman are those Riddler puzzles. Not that I really plan on doing all of them, but they're there and they're mocking me and they're making me feel
and
bad.
And he's literally mocking you.
Yeah, and I don't know if I should be doing these, what the benefit is. I don't know. I think the biggest issue with the Riddler puzzles in Batman is there are so many that are there that you cannot solve. I think that is just... from a design perspective, why would you want to do that to the player?
Yeah, that's the one thing that bothered me about Arkham Knight 2 specifically, although all the games share it in the same way. Yeah. It's like, I don't even understand why this exists. I'm like, this game is so immaculate in so many ways. The presentation, the thought and put into the sequencing of the fucking side quest, the whole side quest wheel, I thought was a great thing to just be able to pop it up and see where you are. And then but then you have all this garbage.
Yeah.
Why? That was
it's
like,
busy
what
work,
the
right?
fuck?
Busy work, keep
the game
going.
Doesn't even need it.
And if
it had it should have just been collectibles that you could find.
Or if it doled out 5 or 10 ever so often. I mean, that's, I think Rockstar is exquisite at this, where you get to a certain point in their games, then you get maybe about 5 missions. You can do it in whatever order. Then you tighten back up into the main story and then you get some. Mm-hmm. You never have that moment of I don't know what the implications of my decisions are going to be. I don't know what to do next. And I think that this concept that, we want the player to play however they want to. No, we want the player to think they can play out.
Yeah,
if
exactly
you're making
right.
the Design. Game, you know what the better way to play this is, and you should kind of nudge the player in that mm-hmm. direction.
Right,
that,
that's a great point, because that's what we've had this argument fucking ad nauseum about Witcher 3, where you do Witcher 3 side quests too early or too late, and you get no experience points for them. And I'm like, and everyone's like, you're not, you know, people are, you're not playing it right. I'm like, what the fuck are you talking about? The game's letting me do it. Therefore, I am playing the game right. That's called bad. I hate to tell you, that's called bad design. And what bothers me is that CD Projekt Red, when they're talking about Cyberpunk now, which is their next game, they're like, it's going to be even bigger. And I'm like, are you fucking kidding me? That's what you learn from The Witcher 3 is you're going to make your next RPG even bigger.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't get any bigger.
But just, you know, but if you wanted more space and more quests, but control, I mean, no, that was devastating where I'm like, you're asking the player to understand things far quicker than there's any reason to expect them to understand it.
Yeah.
And it's like, just give me a few quests. I'm like, oh, I like to do I love doing quests.
Yeah, me too. But not 75 of them.
And Metal Gear, as many quests as there are in there, it never, as long as you're being attentive and you want to do all the side quests, it gives you three or four for every, like, you know, two things you do in the main story.
Metal Gear is the perfect example this year of slowly doling out the stuff, because it's the same thing of like when I was trying to get Nick ready for Metal Gear and I showed him Peace Walker. I jumped into a save that was like
was
60
me.
Or 70
you
hours.
Me.
Oh, sorry, I'm sorry.
And 70, I was like, fuck
70 hours this. In, and I'm like, well, this is how you manage your base, and this number, and you're like, this is bullshit. I'm like, but this isn't how you got dropped into the game.
Yeah.
And so now with Phantom Pain, it is that, where it's like, do this, and then, bink, all right, here's this new thing for you to learn, and this thing to learn, and this thing. And slowly but surely, now you look back 60 hours later, like, oh, fuck.
My only complaint, and I know this is just indicative for a lot of his games and games of this nature, I don't like the scoring at the end of the missions. Because it undermines the idea that you should be able to do it how you want.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's a really good point.
And I'm like, it's almost like they're like, oh, no, but we did have a way we wanted you to play this. And
yeah.
It's like, oh, it's not, you know, it's like, obviously the scores may have no consequence, but it's like, okay, now I'm just neurotic.
Yeah, sure. No, I feel the same way.
That's why Kotaku put up that piece that was like, you know, it's Metal Gear so much fun, better when you ignore it, when you ignore that final screen. Because that's for the nerds like me that want the platinum and love Metal Gear and want to S-rank it and want to sneak in and out and never be
But known. I think there's a difference, though, between that and, like, the Riddler trophy stuff. With the Riddler trophy stuff, it's like, that's just there, you know? Whereas this, it's like, yeah, it's annoying for the people like me that are literally, I just want to beat the mission. Like, I do not care about my rank at all.
Yeah.
But knowing that there's a rank, like, I do like it. I do like knowing that, oh, there is a better way to play this game. You can play it however you want.
Sure.
Obviously, I'm doing that. But there is a way that I should be playing that they want me to be doing that, and they designed it that way.
Yeah.
See, I think that I wish we could move away from traditional difficulty settings and instead be, you know, ask the player at the beginning, how are you hoping to play it? That there should be, like, a completist mode. Where you're not going to go up by level as fast because you're planning to do every side quest, and so it'll keep the game challenging for you. Mm-hmm. I think Dragon Age is a great example. You know, you get so overpowered if you're really diligent about doing the side quest, or like say in the case of Metal Gear, like you don't want to be scored, and so it's going to just remove that element of the game so you can just kind of experience it and play it however you want.
Well, I think the Call of Duty news that dropped this week about them being you can choose
realistic
your campaign whenever you want. You know what I'm talking about? In Black Ops 3, you can, as soon as you play the game, you can choose whatever campaign mission. You don't unlock the campaigns.
Oh, that's lame. I don't like that. But I mean, but I guess the player agency.
Direction,
yeah, but the player. But I agree with
that's
you. In the
just weird.
Yeah, it is weird. But their whole thing is like that they
are they telling a story?
I mean, no, there is a story. It's not like it's non-linear. It is still going to be a linear thing. And I might be getting some of this wrong. I don't think that I am because I read the article, but. They're talking about how, like, you know, back when you played Guitar Hero and stuff and you had to play the songs over and over to unlock everything. It was like, why?
Okay,
and,
no. Okay, I see that logic.
And but that's different because that all those songs are equal, technically, whereas these levels are.
Yeah, it's a campaign.
It's a specific thing. But they're, it's more for the people that just want to just be able to go to the one mission because they don't care about the command. They do just want to do the multiplayer, but they heard that this level's cool and they don't want to have to play. I don't know.
I respect that. And I actually really love what Adam was saying about, like, I love that idea of the game asking you questions in the beginning, 10 questions. You know, how
it
much time do you,
me out.
It doesn't have to be with every game, but a game like The Witcher or
something
like that, where it's like, how much time do you intend on spending with this game?
Yeah.
Like asking you like very straightforward questions and then it gives you like it's not player agency. It's even bigger than that. It's
customer service.
Yeah, it's customization before you even have agency in the game.
I mean,
so it's I like that. It's probably complicated to execute, but I like
exactly.
That.
And it would benefit a game like you're talking about with Batman in the way that the thing you haven't glossed over and the thing that about the Riddler trophies that annoys me as somebody who got them all is the fact that they're mandatory. You don't get the real ending of Batman Arkham Knight, yeah, no matter how many hours you put in, until you get all the things. And they don't tell you that till the end. And it's like, well, what the hell?
There's those Riddler puzzles where, like, you need to get a piece of equipment that will be given to you at some point in the story. But they don't tell you that when you go. I mean, they could have just
you sit there banging your head against the wall.
If Batman just like, I think there's something else I need that I should come back. Something.
Just some clue.
Sure, 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 sure.
I felt very similarly, and I love Dragon Age Inquisition, but to Colin's point, I agree with you. I play games sometimes just to make myself angry. I'm like, if it's there, then I can play it. So certain parts of that map open up, you know, early on. And one of them, I went there, and it's like, I'm at level 6 and somehow it unlocked, but all the enemies are level 13.
Mm.
And, you know, you're going through a fair amount of loads to get there. It's like, just, you know, once again, if a character be like, oh, I don't know, I think it's pretty dangerous up ahead, just something so the player is not
put you back on
wasting
track.
Time pointlessly.
Yeah.
Once again, games are mainly for adults, and adults have other responsibilities.
Yeah, it reminds me of, like, there's very simple ways to nip shit like that in the butt. It reminds me of, like, Dragon Quest. Like old Dragon Quest games on NES. If you walked across a bridge you weren't supposed to walk across, you'd run into enemies that would kill you immediately. And you would learn your lesson that you shouldn't go across that bridge. It's like very simple design philosophy. You know, like, so I think sometimes designers might be getting in their heads a little too much in terms of, like, how do we execute a world this big? And I'm like, I think you don't have to overthink it too much. If the side quest is available, then you should expect that someone's going to do the side quest.
Yes.
It is not. So, like, when I hear this, like, you're playing the game wrong or they didn't play, it's like, what the fuck are you talking about? Mm-hmm. The side quest is available and the game let me play it. Therefore, no, I'm playing the game exactly the way it was intended.
That you can play the game wrong. If I can do that in the game, then that is at the game's behest or at the game's allowance. And
especially with more open world stuff, like Super Metroid, even like there's the rooms where it's too hot, and if you go in there, your life just starts raining down. You instantly know.
Yeah, it's just quick cues. It's the way games used to have to do it because they didn't have the luxury of being able to explain things to you in any other way. So it was usually visual cues or quick death cues that would be still forgiving enough to let you know that, like, you're going back to the last save point and don't go there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I think that's super valuable stuff. The thing that bothers me about Arkham Knight specifically in retrospect is I really enjoyed the beat-to-beat story of that game. I think the game is a little overrated. I don't think the combat is as inspired as everyone thinks it is. I don't. But I do think that the storytelling, and I love that wheel they had of, like, you're this percentage through this and this percentage through this. You don't even know what the fuck this is yet. And when I think of the Riddler trophies, and I just think of game development and game design as a pie, like a structure in which you take different resources to make different things, I wish they took those resources of those fucking stupid Riddler trophies and were like, we're going to do 4 more sets of side quests. You know, wouldn't have that been more fun? And then people would have gotten the real ending by doing something they actually wanted to do, because I got just a million tweets from people being like, because I finished the game. Everyone's like, oh, did you see the real ending? I'm like, no, I didn't. They're like, oh, well, you have to get this and that and the other thing. And everyone's like, just go watch the YouTube video. That's what I did.
And then that's what everyone did.
Yep. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's just like, I hope Rocksteady looks at that and is like, we don't need this minutia in our games necessarily. Some games thrive on that kind of stuff. Witcher is a great example of a game that does thrive on the minutia. But if they wanted to have collectibles, make them so you can find them and get them without having to bang your head against the wall 150 times, whatever it is. It's insane.
It's a funny thing is, you know, I think when developers do it, they're doing it from a good place. But I think sometimes the audience that talks to the developer is that incredible core audience, the ones who will get all the Riddler trophies. And you can get kind of a mistaken perception of who that much, much larger audience is, which is, you know, other people who are like, I can't. I would love to see a real ending. I mean, now that you told me there's a fake ending, do I even want to get to the end of the game? Right. Yeah. I mean, that's really not, a very good message to be conveying to someone.
Yeah, I agree. That's a great point. Yeah, I think Arkham Knight's an interesting game because I think it can teach us, and just developers, quite a bit about how to do things right and how to do things wrong.
No, it's one of the things I love the most when I was reviewing games is games that weren't perfect were so much more interesting because the experiment that doesn't completely work can be so much more instructive than the game that does everything perfectly.
Sure.
It's.
Mm-hmm. Before we move on to the topic, I definitely need to stand up for Nintendo and just throw Mario Maker.
I was going to, yeah, we don't get out of here without that.
You know, it's interesting with Nintendo. Obviously, I love it a lot and I want to find the good in it. But I remember back at IGN, I was always the guy, one of the few guys that was like, hey, don't forget about Mario 3D World, or don't forget about Smash Bros, don't forget about Donkey Kong Tropical Freeze, don't forget about Fire Emblem Awakening, all these things that are like, they're not going to win just because of, you know, just how the market is now.
Yeah.
But to me, those were my games of the year, you know, and like I had the most fun with that. And then I was thinking about Nintendo. I was like, man, like this year was bad. Like, it was really bad. Like, there, 3DS or Wii U, like, there's nothing that I could really be like, yes, except for Mario Maker. And Mario Maker, definitely, I would put in that league with Until Dawn and Rocket League, and that it has legs because of streaming and because of this stuff. And people are having so much fun with it. They were when it came out. They still are. I have a feeling they're going to be playing it in half a year.
The interesting thing about it is I think the legs will work against it for Game of the Year.
Yep.
That it is so expansive that maybe you never got deep enough to see the awesome stuff. Maybe mm-hmm. you still do, but you're still seeing people get better and better at what they're making. Whereas when we sit down and go, Witcher, Fallout,
here's the experience.
Metal Gear, here's this like thing that was 50 hours of my life, and I did everything, mm-hmm. and I put it away, and I had a great time.
Yeah.
I've wondered, because, yeah, I've noticed how thin the offerings have been for the Wii U this year. That is, there's something about the Wii U, obviously the controller, that works. I haven't played any Mario Maker. Mm-hmm. That's so essential to making Mario Maker work, that this is one game that they wouldn't want to put off
mm-hmm.
for whatever their next announcement is going to be.
We say X is going to give it to you, and we talk about the NX. NX, yeah. It's coming. It'll save everything.
Well, that whatever they have planned, this would not work very well
exactly.
through controller or something like that. I mean, yeah. I've started to think that.
And I think that that's definitely true. I also think that they're in this weird space between where they have to get some of their games out. I'm still starting to wonder about Zelda now. I don't
think it's a good idea to put Zelda out.
No, I mean, I don't think so
you
either.
You need to consider the Wii U a wash.
Yeah.
Have a Zelda at the launch of a new thing. That helps immeasurably. You have such a signature game at mm-hmm. the launch of your new
console.
It
feels like it's going to be Twilight Princess again, right? Yeah. Where it's going to be, there'll be the Wii U version or whatever, and then there's going to be the NX version that comes at the launch day, and there it is.
How many Wii U's are out there?
11 million, maybe, something like that.
I don't think it's worth it.
Yeah, I don't think so either, in the sense that
the cost is worth it.
I think that when they did that with Twilight Princess, and they just inverted the game and put it on Wii, which was obnoxious because Link's a fucking lefty. and it just changed the whole dynamic of the game. I always thought that was weird. Like, you just it's the mirror image. They put it out on GameCube in limited numbers, but I still think it hurt. It didn't hurt Wii sales because Wii was flying off the shelves. But I think the NX isn't going to sell well without games. It's just not. The Wii U crashed and burned, and mm-hmm. they need to do something right on it. So I hope that if they are moving Zelda over, that they just move it over.
Yeah,
and they don't have the Wii U version at all. You know,
yeah, I'd be shocked if they did that. I understand there's going to be some angry people, but I think you need to just kind of cut your losses on loyalty.
Yeah,
and deal with you have to build this business back up again.
Yeah, absolutely. And to be perfectly honest with you, and it's just the raw numbers of it. And this is coming from what I always say, a reformed Nintendo fan, because I am, is they don't have that much loyalty anymore. I mean, I hate to tell people that.
Well,
If there was a lot of loyalty, Wii U would sell 50 million units.
I think the loyalty will be the people that understand that that's what should happen. They will buy the new one because they're putting the Zelda.
They just need to see the case made.
Yeah.
I mean, look.
Well, that's me.
It's not that hard to get someone to buy something Nintendo. It is rather impressive when you can get someone to not buy something Nintendo, and that is the situation that they're in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I do think optically it's a bad move with Wii U consumers, but Wii U consumers are the hardcore Nintendo consumers that are going to buy the new system. So you need to get, I agree with you. The trajectory for all the numbers is just down in the gutter. And so there's just not that much brand loyalty for Nintendo. And that's just the reality of the situation. And so I agree with you, just cut your losses and piss some people off. But this is the right thing to do, is put all of your games, release your 15-year-old looking Star Fox game, put the Wii U to bed, and start out fresh with a Zelda game, get a Metroid Prime game on there, I think Retro is working on a Wii U or an NX game. Just get your first parties going mm-hmm. and firing on all cylinders and make this a compelling machine for core gamers.
Yeah. I mean, and that's key, because I think the people that have Wii U's that enjoy them fucking love them. And I know that because I've had multiple games on it that I'm like, I fucking love these games. And so we're going to buy it. I'm going to buy it no matter what, because it's Nintendo and I'm supporting it. And no matter what happens, I'm going to get a Mario game. I'm going to get a Zelda game. I'm going to get a Metroid. These are the games I want to play. It's worth it for me.
It's
the Wii U is worth it for me to be able to play the games that I played.
I just hate that controller so much.
Yes.
I
Fisher like Price piece of trash.
It's just, it was playing Wind Waker, which I was all excited for.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, wait, but they put the buttons down here.
Yeah, the buttons are below the sticks. I can't believe that was when I started, the first game I played on it was Mass Effect 3 when we were at IGN. I had to review it, the port. And I played online, and I'm like, what? Why did they put the face buttons below the sticks?
Pro controller.
The amount, the distance for your thumb to travel from mm-hmm. stick to the most important button, which is the one at the bottom of your diamond, that changes everything if you're having to be reactive when you're playing a game.
It's truly bizarre.
The bottom of Bayonetta, which maybe it worked, but I'm like, that game, I have to be quick in my reflexes, and this... Mm-hmm. That doesn't do it.
It's a bizarre.
And they did it on the Pro controller.
Yeah.
The Pro controller is the thing that doesn't make
absolutely,
sense.
It's absolutely bizarre. I
the Wii U's been so awesome.
The Wii U's been really bad, but I do agree that the there are games on every platform, including Wii U, that are good. But I will dispute you that you got a Mario game. You really,
dude,
didn't
3D
get a
World
Mario
was
game.
Freaking awesome.
It's fine, but that's not like. We were talking about how the games get short shrift in Game of the Year, for instance. But when I remember, because we were at IGN at the time, you weren't there yet. Mario Galaxy won Game of the Year by a fucking mile.
Yeah. No.
And so it's not like people have this necessarily inherent bias against Nintendo games. It's just that these games are not the Mario games we're looking for.
Totally
anymore.
Get that.
Especially the one that the system launched with, or that came out around launch, whatever, which was basically just a facsimile of a game that people had already played. You know?
It was still good, though. It was still fun. And like, I'm totally with you. I would never argue that I don't want the Mario Galaxy like 3-esque thing, or not even Mario Galaxy 3. I'll definitely want that, but like a new thing, you know,
from
the new big Mario. This is what Mario on the Wii U is.
You'll get it on NX. Right. I'm sure that they were making it for Wii U, and I'm sure very early on they were like
oh, no, we can't. And like, fine, I'm down, because like, whatever. I did get two Mario games that, and I've said this many times, Mario has different pillars now, where there's the 2D games, there's the 3D like adventure games, like Mario 64, where it's like you're getting stars, and then there's the 3D obstacle course games, and I fucking love that. 3D Land and 3D World are so awesome, and people hate on them because they're not that other thing, but I'm happy there's this third.
See, all I think Nintendo needs to do is that they have a box, this NX, and it's just a subscription service. Like, they are sitting on some of the most valuable IPs on the planet.
Yeah.
Get them ready, and then I can just stream some of them, or that, like, for a fee, I can get 20 of them. Just give me your back catalog, and then if they do that, then they can still be kind of slow getting new games out, because you've given me what I really love you for, which is all these memories from the NES,
nostalgia,
from the SNES, from the GameCube, from the N64. I mean, it's sitting there waiting. I mean, it's just, to me, it's just crazy that they have these games that are just not earning money.
No, I agree. I mean, the IP situation is compelling to me as well, because it's not only valuable gaming IP, that's some of the most valuable IP in entertainment.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that's really always been frustrating to me. But you said a lot there, kind of between the lines, and I don't know if you meant it or not, which is that no one's really looking at Nintendo excited about what they're going to do. It's all people want is to play the things they've already done.
Yeah.
And that says a great deal about what people think about that company now. And Nintendo's prospects of really succeeding with the NX, and I hope they do succeed, because I think a healthy Nintendo is good for a healthy industry. But it also begs the question, maybe they should just start making games for other people, you know, and put those games on other platforms and do what they do best.
I really think apparently, I'm an apostate for saying it, but yeah, I think
NX has got to be the last gasp at it.
I mean, that sucks because, like, to me, and this is coming from a huge fucking Nintendo fan that will buy the console before any games announced for, just based on what I think I might get.
Yeah.
But I wish that the Wii U was their last console. I wish that we would just get the games, because I just want the fucking games. I don't care. I don't care about anything.
I want to play games with a normal controller.
That's it.
Play Mario with a DualShock 4
controller.
Or that brilliant Xbox One controller, that beautiful Xbox One controller. Like, that Elite controller, playing like whatever you want, playing Mario Kart on that controller, like
getting trophies.
Like, I just, it's just so, what Nintendo doesn't have. Nintendo might have a shortage of a lot of things right now. What they don't have a shortage of is fucking incredible pride. And they're going to go down with that ship, man. And I don't think the ship's going down. They have a lot of money and valuable IP. They'll always have money. They can always sell it. Disney might buy them one day or something like that. Who knows? But it's, I'm sure they haven't even tried yet. Maybe they have. I just feel like Adam said a lot. Like, it's just like he wants to play NES and SNES games and N64 games.
I want to play GameCube games.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
like, GameCube was awesome.
Toadstool Tour, please.
But Geist. I just won't play Geist.
No. But that says, I think that's in the heart of a lot of gamers today, a lot of reformed Nintendo fans like me, a lot of people that weren't into Nintendo or just want to know the past. It's like, no one's really that interested in the future, but I hope they just punch me in the face.
I mean, I definitely don't think that's a true statement, that no one's interested. I think everyone's interested in what happens.
Well, people are interested in what happens, but people are not interested in what they're doing right now, clearly. So it's, you know, I mean, the market has spoken loud and clear about Wii U, and it's not, and to your point, it's not that they don't have a shortage of games. I really think there's a shortage of interest, you know, because people feel burned by this shit. You know, look at they really reformed 3DS, but even 3DS came out of the gate and fucking fell on its face. You know, it's like, these things don't happen in Nintendo products. So it's they have to think deeply about the way that they do the NX, and I'm sure that their plans are already in place, and I'm sure we're going to see it at E3 and all that kind of stuff. But I'm excited and interested in it. And as someone, like, I took this, what I always say is I took this cycle off with Nintendo. I don't play the Wii U. with the exception of a few games. If they can get me back, fucking get me back. I was telling Greg the other day, we're trophy whores, right? I'm like, if they just had their own achievement system and it went all the way back through the virtual console, goodbye.
Yeah.
You know, like I'll be in the depths of the NES catalog for five fucking years before you see me again.
I mean, the other thing is, I mean, I guess I could play it on my Wii U, but it's just like, just give me Galaxy, but give it to me in high def. You know, whatever Dolphin version of it looks like. I mean, I could play Galaxy till the cows come home. I love that game so much. Mm-hmm. And it's like Nintendo is the only company where like I actually hunger to play their older games.
Yeah.
Because they are so well designed. And, you know, because I'm not like, God, I need to play Azeric on the original Xbox. No one said that. Yeah. Other people do look back to play games from Nintendo. And I think that's why it drives me just nuts that they don't. I mean, they could actually fill the time in between proper new games with stuff like that. Mm-hmm. If they just had a console that was normal enough and you could adapt a controller to whatever that game is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And of course, the wild card. It would be a similar wild card when we were talking about Vita 2 if they ever did a new Vita. They're not going to, but if Sony did a new Vita and they're like, how did they get third parties involved? Like, third parties were burned badly on this thing. Wii U burned a lot of third parties badly to the point where they were delaying games like Rayman to get them out on other consoles.
Yeah.
You know, before they even released on Wii U. That's the other wild card is if they're not ready with all pistols firing with first and second party games, they are going to be fucked because I can't imagine that they're going to Ubisoft and EA and EA is like, yeah, let's do this again.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
I mean, like, I hope they don't, man. I hope that they're like,
I'm going to put my dick on the table with the hammer. Yeah, wow, that hurts. Oh, that's right. It does.
They have to do it. They have to. Nintendo's got it's going to be, it's very interesting to be a fly on the wall of that place right now because they know exactly what they have to do and they are going to have to engender a lot of third party support as well. And they're going to have to get big third party games on that console. They have to because they have a Nintendo machine right now.
Mm hmm.
You know, they have a Nintendo game machine right now.
I think the trick is Nintendo at the launch, they have to do it all on their own. But if they have a Zelda, if they have a Metroid and all that stuff, boom, there you have the install base. They will come back. But I don't think anyone's going to take that leap of faith again.
All the developers are going to stand on the side.
Have a killer lineup at a launch and you can sustain it with your own software for maybe the first 9 months, maybe the first year. Then you'll see a turnaround. EA will come back. Ubisoft
for sure. I mean, that's the thing is like people, no one wanted to buy the Wii U to play freaking Arkham City.
Yeah, was a weird port.
But that's the thing, that was their third-party support and stuff like that. It's like,
but they also just let them... Well, it's not letting them. I mean, these companies are... they can do whatever they want. They're, like, sentient. I actually absolutely agree with you. And I think that's why things are quiet right now. They do have a stable of very good first-party games or first-party studios. And your point, like, they do make really good games. Like, they make good games. It's just that hardware that holds them back. And I hope that's the other thing with NX. We can save it for another time is that the NX needs to be powerful. It needs to be more powerful than you expect it's going
to
be.
Which means it needs to be expensive, which is one of those things that I don't know. They've always made money on their consoles at launch. And it's like, maybe this time you have to lose some money.
Yeah,
maybe
and they
you
have
to go razor blade this time.
And they have a war chest. Everyone always talks about this vaulted fucking war chest they have. Well, they're gonna have to go into it and lose some money.
Yes. Stop building things out of petty cash. Go to cash. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, like $18-20 billion on hand. They can afford some losses. That I agree with you. They have to get it out. They're gonna sell these consoles at a loss probably, but it's gotta be powerful. And I hope it's a hybrid, but we'll see what happens.
Ladies and gentlemen, that topic was brought to you by DraftKings. Put your fantasy skills to the test starting Sunday at DraftKings.com, America's favorite one-week fantasy football site, where you could kick the season off by winning $2 million. It's the biggest fantasy football contest ever. $10 million in prizes are up for grabs, including $2 million for first place and $1 million for second. One-week fantasy means no season-long commitments. It's fantasy football on demand. Play where you want, when you want, with the players you want. This isn't fantasy as usual. This is DraftKings. Welcome to the big time. Hurry to DraftKings.com now and use promo code KINDOFFUNNY to play for a free shot at a pot of $10 million in Sunday's Millionaire Maker event. And are kind of funny for free entry now only at DraftKings.com. That's DraftKings.com. So, Adam, the third topic today is your favorite games of all time.
What are they?
So a long time ago, we had a show where the entire week was each of us giving our five favorite games of all time. So for you, I asked you to kind of come with your five. We don't need to do that. We can just do... When I asked you the questions, what are your favorite games of all time? What comes to mind?
What I was starting to do in my head is I was going through generations of consoles. Because then I can start to hone in on what were my favorite at the time. So with the NES, Super Mario. I actually didn't get Super Mario 3 until much later. And my family didn't have a ton of money. So trust me, the things I had to go through for that one game. But you know, dark obviously Super Mario Brothers, but the one that I still love is Ghosts and Goblins.
Because, that's a rough one, man. That's a great game, but it's hard as fucking nails game.
I was young enough, I didn't know that. I just thought this is games. I used to go to this, it's kind of an arcade. It was a bowling alley near my house. I probably should not have been going there at the age I was all by myself, but I found this way to save money where I would ask my friend's parents to give me a ride to a BART station so I didn't have to take the bus, so I could pocket the bus money. At the end of the week, I had enough quarters and I would go to that arcade and I'd try to play Ghosts and Goblins. And I couldn't get past the first level. And then finally, it comes out for the home version on the NES. And like I worked at it and worked at it and worked at it and worked at it. And I finally like beat the Satan or whatever it is at the end. And it's like, that's not the real one. You got to go back and play it again. And I think that's when I started to develop my own personal philosophies about how I see the world as a really shitty place. That fucks with you all the time.
That is one of the cruelest games of all time.
So awful. But I love that game so much because that was the first time. I think it's one of the first games that had a real sense of art direction. And that I wanted to play it not for a score, not for bragging rights. I want to see what the next level looked like.
Mm.
What weird ass enemies that don't make any sense are they there? And I think it really informed my philosophy of how I like to play games. I want to see what's around the corner.
Mm.
In terms of the sense of success is less interesting to me than I want to get lost in somebody else's far more interesting imagination than mine. So
interesting.
So okay, that's NES.
You left off your Sega Master System. What's your Sega Master System?
Okay, I didn't have that, but my buddy Andre did. And that was like, because I was the kid, like, I actually got an NES, like, right around the time it launched. I think it was my parents were worried I was getting really lonely and I could get friends this way. My buddy Andre, he got a Sega Master System. I got more friends.
He didn't know
you and I liked the Sega Master System? Fantasy Zone.
Mm.
Because it doesn't make any sense. It's like, once upon a time, you got to make games like Fantasy Zone, where it's like, what is it? I don't know.
Just put it out.
We're going to shoot some things, and it looks all weird, and there's a lot of round edges. Sure thing. All right. Put it on the Sega Master System. Ship it. So, I mean, those two from, like, the early era I really like. I didn't play a ton on SNES. That's when I was in college. And just games were not going to happen.
Sure.
What little you're I had was going to beer.
Yeah. It's one or the other.
But then when I started, you know, I was on GameSpot TV. I mean, one of the games that always will stand out to me is Banjo-Kazooie.
Mm.
Because, you know, because I ended around the time of the SNES. I was aware of, like, Street Fighter, stuff like that. But I missed as things started to move into 3D. So I get this job, and they're like, cool, you know something about games. You need to know more. You got to go play some. So the first big game that came out around that time was Banjo. And I popped it in. I'm like, oh my God. You know, it's just that overworld.
How far we've come.
Yeah. I'm like, this is really cool. And my roommates hated me because all they heard, like, on a Saturday morning while everyone was hungover is, woo, ee.
Turn that shit off.
Yeah, and I guess that year also was Half-Life. I think that was the first time I had seen, like, adult game.
Mm.
I guess earlier that year. Because the thing about 1998 was... Half-Life was so big. That was also the year of Ocarina of Time.
And Metal Gear.
Wait, no, was that Metal Gear 1?
Yeah.
Metal Gear Solid, yeah.
Was that Metal Gear Solid?
I think they were all in the same month.
It might have been.
Because, somebody deemed it the greatest month.
November 98.
I go over my head. I'm trying to remember where I was sitting at work when I played it, because that's how I can start to figure out the date.
Sure.
But the big games that were supposed to be coming out that year was Ritual Sin and Shogo from Monolith. And both of those actually weren't good.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and Unreal came out that year as well. Because it was like one of the first engines that allowed you to go from indoors to outdoors seamlessly.
Mm.
I mean, that was such a nutty year.
Yeah.
But like Half-Life, that was the first time where I'm like, oh, hold on. There's something really interesting happening here in the industry. So was that 4?
Yeah.
What else? What else do I like? I mean, I really do like most games.
Mm-hmm. You said Galaxy. Earlier you're talking about Galaxy.
That's right. Super Mario Galaxy. I love platformers, and that to me was...
It's like perfection, man, especially for 3D.
It was. I remember I got it. We got a good and early from Nintendo for review because we would say, yeah, we need it for video, so please give it to us a month early. And we actually got it. So I went back to review it, and it was a Friday, and I was going to go see some friends and put it in. I thought it was going to be fine, but it was a Wii game, so I didn't know how it was going to work. And like I just blew through the first world, and I'm like, what the hell? I mean, I'm... I was just like, I cannot believe what I'm playing here. Because every single level felt fresh and different.
Yeah. I mean, well, going back to what you're talking about with Ghosts and Goblins, where you wanted to see the next level, Mario Galaxy is full of that. Where you're like, what the hell?
And the way that they would... It would find like a certain type of way. Okay, we're going to challenge you on this kind of logic. Okay, we're going to have small gravitational things you walk around. You'd have one of those, then maybe two levels later, you'd have it. They would return to it, but they would do it in a way that didn't feel like, okay, we're just going to test you again, but now we're going to test you more with you. We're just going to make it harder. Like everything felt purposeful in its design, and it should be there in the game, except for the purple stars.
Right.
Yeah, forget that.
Things happen.
I will say that to Galaxy's credit, because I always had the Wii reservations too, although not at the time. I was still kind of in the Wii in 2007. The waggle felt totally normal. Everything about that, everything about that
thing,
game was,
man. The key was when you played
innate.
It and you're just like, oh, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It worked. It did work to its credit.
I mean, I know Uncharted 2 is that's one of those moments I'll never forget. You know, that was a rough year. That was like kind of the year my wife had gotten sick, and, you know, we had moved to a new place, which was great. And I was like, all right, maybe I'll, that's right. I wasn't supposed to review it. It was supposed to be somebody else. And they're like, hey, Adam, I don't think we have time. Do you mind? I'm like, I'm free this weekend. Went home, popped it in. And I was like, oh, hi. And that's when I came up with the term, the underwear game. And the underwear game is what happened the following morning. It was Saturday morning and I got up in my underwear and I stepped over my wife. Tiptoed out the room, closed the door, made a cup of coffee because I wanted to see if I could get maybe 2 or 3 hours before she woke up where I would have fully uninterrupted play.
Yeah.
And I have now come up with another term called the shower game. And that's my, I should play that game. Eh, I'm probably going to take a shower first.
We've all been there.
Yeah. Is there any...
Do any of the Witchers fall into this? You were saying you're a big Witcher fan.
I am, but they don't... I'm trying to think of the ones where it was like, okay, that
like life changing, like it has a moment in time for you. I understand.
I would say maybe Last of Us or Bioshock Infinite. Pat I think upon. A lot of people obviously disagree with me on Infinite, but that is still one of those where I'm like, I am lost in someone's nutty imagination, and I'm really, really enjoying this.
How do you feel about it compared to, because Bioshock the original is like one of my favorite games. Yeah. How do you feel about the original Bioshock compared to Infinite?
I love the original Bioshock. In an odd way, I think the original Bioshock is still less individualistic from a creative standpoint. I think it's a stronger game in terms of just sort of like how some of the challenges present themselves, but just kind of the flash of color, the aesthetics, and all that stuff that's happening in Infinite. You know,
it's Columbia is certainly a different place. Yeah.
Yeah. It's funny. Even though they both carry the name Bioshock and they have certain thematic consistencies, I see them as very, very different games.
Oh, yeah.
No, they are. They are different. Yeah. That was one of the things that turned me off to Infinite a little bit, although I always feel like I'm in the minority, so it's funny that you feel in the minority, too, when you're saying that. Because I'm always
probably
like...
Probably because I praised it so heavily, and so when people decide... Cause you know what happens? Like, a bunch of people praise the game. 2 weeks later, there's like all those other articles. Well, hold on. Yeah. A reconsideration.
I'm unfamiliar with that, Tim.
Yeah, shit happens. No, you're right.
So I tend... You know, if you praise the game, you tend be very aware when those 2 weeks come.
Yeah. Oh no, absolutely. I got that with the Last of Us and the Uncharted games and other things. So we still get it with Uncharted 3 all the time.
No, but the other one I just forgot. I think my favorite series of all time is Mass Effect.
I was going to say Mass Effect. About Mass Effect. Okay.
That's you know, I still dream that one day they'll go back and redo one.
Oh, I was going to ask. So you don't like that? So you're one of the ones that's more of a 2 or 3 purist as opposed to the one like RPG heavy RPG mechanic.
Oh no, is that the RPG mechanics weren't the issue? It was just the problems, like the Mako and
elevators.
Know, well, that's just let's.
That's just the game at the time.
That's what was going to happen. No, the Arachnite Queen. I mean, that boss battle has serious, serious problems, and you know, just tweak that one up. Maybe make it a little bit more consistent, but I think I would say 2 or 3 go down easier. Though I did miss like the level of depth.
Yeah,
I guess the thing is, I never felt that one benefited from the depth. Like once you started to invest in some of those skills, like, well, I better just go all the way with those. I never felt like you could mix and match very comfortably in it. And also, I think that's because of KOTOR, because I went kind of down the middle. And that game does not.
That
like
doesn't
you
reward. Down you, that does not
I,
reward n- you.
Notoriously, I was writing the strategy guide for KOTOR when I was a freelancer at IGN, and it's a notorious story. Like Hillary still brings it up, who is our old boss, and at the time was writing guides. Where I got the Vader, or what? It wasn't Vader. Whatever the last boss was, Revan.
Yeah.
And I couldn't beat him. I couldn't beat him. Like no matter what, I was like, I can't beat him. And they're like, And Hillary had to write the last part of the guide for me because I'm like, I can't. I actually think I tried to be totally neutral, yeah, and you and I fucked myself. And the game does not tell you that.
Yeah.
You know, so you're. That's like one of my dark memories of writing strategy. Yeah.
How long did it take you to fight him? Of fighting him to discover you couldn't do it.
I did it a few times because Hillary and I were writing the guide in concert. I was doing like I was making Paragon choices, I think, and he was making like Renegade choices or whatever. So like Sith and whatever
yeah,
Jedi
yeah, yeah.
choices.
Light, dark.
But I was like keeping my skill tree. So I don't remember. It was a long time ago. It was 12 years ago now, which is incredible. And I remember just getting to a point where I'm like, I just think I screwed myself and I can't go back. You know,
yeah.
like
I
can't, I'll never forget that as long as KOTOR is a great game though.
KOTOR is an amazing
game. It's funny you say that about Mass Effect though, because I've had this mental conundrum with that series for a while. Cause I love that series too. Where I think they got some feedback from EA. I think they got some feedback from more casual gamers that were like, this is too much of a role playing game.
Remember, and the first one was Microsoft.
So yeah,
my funny feeling is maybe they were not being monitored as heavily
right.
back then.
That's true. That's a good point. It was a Microsoft game that somehow came to PlayStation later. That I think they got some feedback and some maybe some you know focus testing, whatever. They're like, it's just you guys got to scale it back. And I've often wondered, would I trade the gains taken in 2 and 3 in certain ways to get that role playing system back? And I think and that statistical system back. And I think I might. You know?
The story and the storytelling, more importantly, is so much better in 2 and 3. And that's where I'm getting really attached to these characters. And by the time 3 rolls around, it's just like, what? I mean, yeah. just seeing how everything is finally happening and you're seeing, you know, I had a couple of things that shocked because I somehow stopped the genophage and I didn't, and no one died.
Oh, on a mission?
Yeah.
Nice
because
job.
I played such heavy Renegade, uh-huh. like crazy,
oh, really?
crazy Renegade.
I'm always so uncomfortable making bad choices in games.
Yeah,
I don't know.
See, that Paragon. One, you don't know because you're not, it didn't, in KOTOR, I panicked. When I tried to play Renegade at the very beginning, because I think this woman has been assaulted. And the way I tried to react to it was, you know, as Renegade, I can't remember, or you know, Dark Force.
Whatever the name was, yeah.
And as I did that, I panicked. I turned off my Xbox. And you know, I think it was plugged into the internet. I'm like, maybe it's reporting me, and they know I'm a bad person. I really had that deep a reaction to it, and I felt that like, what they really got to in Mass Effect is you're trying to get to the same place, be you Paragon or Renegade. You're a little more dickish about how you go about it, but it's not like
Brash.
Everyone hates you.
Right. No, that was the thing for me with Mass Effect, and then Mass Effect 2 is that Mass Effect I jumped into and tried to get into, and I got turned off. By how deep the RPG stuff was and how just like dense it was
now,
dense
you
like you were
skill
saying
trees,
it. No it was more talking to everyone and feeling like I was, if I didn't talk to everyone I wasn't getting the XP so it wasn't worth my and I stopped playing it because it was just like I'm not gonna get invested and then 2 came around and stopped rewarding you. It didn't give you any rewards for talking to people. Now it was, are you in it for the games, how do you want to go, and then building your squad. And like Mass Effect 2 is totally that thing of like I'll never forget Jacob's mission and going out there and
yeah.
Jack's mission and like the connection you had to those characters when I wasn't worrying about like, well, fuck, there's a guy over there, let's talk to him, what do you think?
Yeah, no, you're right there. The one thing though, I think that I really think 3 is a great game in many ways. I think it's the best game in the series in terms of storytelling. I think people were pretty hard on it. I always
way too hard
because I always describe it as like what were you exactly expecting. I always describe the story as an upside down pyramid. At some point you have to get back to the focus peak of it, and it has to end.
Yeah.
You know, so like, I don't know what the fuck you wanted them to do. You wanted to end in 15 different ways. It's not possible. Nonetheless, I think that by the time we got to 3, they removed all of the role playing elements. You were getting like no experience for anything except for like beating missions. Like you had no, there was no, we were talking about agents before.
It was
almost
like a JRPG at that, I guess. I'm trying to.
Like I just felt like you were, there was no way for me to like finagle a little more experience or like
to just get that edge on the game.
Yeah,
because
exactly.
That's what I love about a role playing game.
Exactly.
Like,
when you turn that corner,
I'm like, I can destroy all y'all.
Yeah. I felt like it was too stuck in not being a role playing game.
I have
anymore.
A funny feeling they are going to address that. With,
I hope so.
With the new one.
I hope so. I can't wait for Andromeda. And I hope that's what I'm saying is I want them to marry those deep systems that Mass Effect was big because of the people that this, and this is lost on a lot of people. And I understand that people like 2 and 3. Mass Effect 1's fans were the ones that made it possible for 2, and they should at least give an homage to them to say like, you know, like we're going to put those role playing statistics back into the game and make it more of a role playing game.
2012, that's when it came out, correct? 3.
Mass Effect
yes, because that's when
7,
G4
10 and 12.
Me. Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember now because I remember.
Oh wait, I know why I remember.
No,
this.
The story is because when I wrote the review, it's a downer of a review. It's because that was the 4 month period where I knew that, you know, the rumors were going around. I couldn't escape them. So here I like to get the game is just this ex. You know, my review is just this existential dread is just filling it.
Yeah,
and I talked about the ending. I'm like, yeah, you know, I mean, it has this ending where it, you know. Yeah, nothing matters. It's all what you did before. Yeah, it's because you're going to die. But Skyrim had been the previous year. So I think what's interesting is up until this point, I might be wrong. There was probably a couple exceptions. You didn't see a lot of open world coming out of EA. And with Skyrim, we start to see that huge push in that direction, that is a economically viable and recommended way to go. So I think that also, I think, opens things up, that they're going to need to have a deeper, people more comfortable now with those mechanics. So I'm not saying the game's going to be open world per se,
right?
But when you do open world, you have to sort of deepen a lot of those systems. Elements.
Yeah. Well, that's a good point, that EA could learn something from Bethesda about scaling in an open world, but that in many ways, BioWare had already identified an open platform in a galactic way of letting you explore planets and stuff like that without giving you a whole planet to explore, kind of like a No Man's Sky kind of thing where you land and you can just go wherever you want and stuff like that. I'd like to see them. The brilliance about going to Andromeda Galaxy, since everything's, you know, spoilers from Aspect, it's fucking over in the Milky Way, is that this doesn't tie them to anything that's real anymore. And so what I'm most excited about is that we don't know anything about the Andromeda Galaxy other than that it's closest to us and then it exists. So, what will you find there?
Can we go to the floaty, jellyfish-looking people planet? Yeah, I really want to go there.
Was it the Hanar?
Yeah, that's right.
So I'd love... what I'm excited about with Andromeda is for them to open up a new trilogy. And what I'm really excited about for them is that they are going to wrap it back into the original trilogy. I fucking know it. And you are going to find yourself back in the Milky Way. And trying to... My whole theory about it is that it's going to be like some sort of time thing with the Reapers and like trying to undo what they did or whatever by like beating them to the punch or like using... I think that they're going to tie it back in. And I think that that's going to be really exciting.
That's cool.
You know? But, you know, I'm just making that up. But that's what I thought.
Well, you got me excited for this game.
But that's what
ass to Montreal and get him to do this.
I think that's the setup. I really do. I think that's the setup, is that they go to, you know, you're in Andromeda and they hear something about what happened in this other place. Mm-hmm. And it's totally different characters. And they go back to the Milky Way and they find that it's dead. And it's like, what happened and all that. I think it's going to be good. Yeah.
Before moving on topics, I really want to know what your thoughts are on Mario 64. Because... you said you came back to Banjo-Kazooie and you love
really
Mario Galaxy.
I think Banjo's the superior game.
Oh my God.
There's no question. And I think it's you know, it's mainly because there's no overworld. There's no proper overworld in Mario 64. And that, to me, was so clever in Banjo, the way that you would travel around and you would have to figure out where the puzzle piece was to unlock the door that was somewhere else inside of that. It made the entire game feel so cohesive, so that when I went back and I tried to play Mario 64, and I mean, the level design is great, but it was, okay, jump in that picture. Okay, now I can go into those pictures, but it's kind of what we were talking about earlier. It didn't have that nice kind of structure and that cohesion. It just felt like more or less a series of exercises.
Mm-hmm.
In contrast, great exercises, but there was that extra special thing that came out.
That's the key difference, though. That's why I love Mario 64, just because it is just like level to level, and the hub world of the castle I love so much as its own thing. But yeah, the open world, even the open, the world thing of Banjo, I'm like, no, I can't do it.
I was going to say, you know, the superior game to Mario 64, which is Super Mario Sunshine.
I hate you so much.
Has a great little hub world called Delfino Plaza.
The worst.
Game sucks.
The worst hub world of any of the Mario games,
Delfino
including Galaxy.
Plaza.
And Galaxy's hub world was not good. That was probably one of my least favorite things.
It's funny because that didn't bother me.
Really? It's
no.
Like, that's
and
a
here I am complaining about Mario
64.
64.
Yeah.
I think just, you know what? I think another was camera controls.
Yeah.
I can't remember what the Banjo camera, they were similar to.
It was similar to Mario. It was a little bit better.
Yeah.
Because it came out later and they understood it a little more. But.
Okay, Sunshine, you just blew my mind.
I know. It's
like, I don't even follow him down this hole. All
right. We'll hold hands and go down whenever you want.
Moving on to the last topic of the day. I asked our beautiful audience over at the Kinda Funny forums. Go to kindoffunny.com/forums. Fill out your topic. We'll read it on the show. These are all geared towards Mr. Adam right here.
I saw a few of these.
Yes. So good. So you can prep for it.
Yes.
This starts with our boy Sean Pitts. He wants to know, what are you playing right now and what are you looking forward to this year?
I'm playing Metal Gear Solid now. I'm slowly making my way through it. I'm really looking forward to Fallout 4. That's a big surprise. I'm really looking forward to Halo 5.
Yes.
I like Halo, and this looks like this is being done with a lot of care and attention. So. Mm-hmm.
I can't wait for Halo 5.
Ratchet 3 wants to know, what's your most anticipated 2016 game?
Mass Effect Andromeda.
Yeah.
I hope it hits.
If it doesn't come out, I mean, that really is a gaping hole in my heart.
I think it will. I think that's going to be a good fall 2016 game.
Yeah.
Marzel wants to say, wants to know, predict how PSVR and Oculus Rift and VR in general will impact gaming in 2016 and beyond.
I'm very excited about VR. You know, I've been working with this company. I know people who are working on VR games. I think there's a ridiculous amount of potential. I still don't know if games are going to be the biggest significant thing out of the gate or if it's going to be like live entertainment. Mm-hmm. To be honest, I'm so excited to be able to maybe plop down $200 and get a front row seat for a prize fight. Mm-hmm. Because I will never afford that seat in real life. And there's so much potential there. I think that we're going to see some really neat games, but it's going to take a while because it is a different medium. And both from an economic point of view, unless it's Oculus or Valve making the game, everybody else is going to need to do two SKUs. And I think a game for a console is not going to work as a game for VR. That it's a much different experience, and you almost don't need the same level of challenge. I have a buddy of mine who's working on Narcosis that has a VR version.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah,
we've done that.
David Chen. And one of the thoughts I had when I was in it is I wasn't looking for combat or the scary. I've never been in a submarine underwater. The sheer novelty of that is so strong that you have to rethink what's going to be happening. That I don't think I need as much gaminess in my VR experience, or at least in the beginning. Maybe we'll become so jaded to it as the years go on. We need to have something that's more deeply interactive and challenging to make it happen. I think Sony's is the biggest bet because it is tied to the console. If they can pull it off, all power to them. I see a little bit more risk there. Obviously, the Valve and the initiative from Oculus, they are backed by some very, very large companies that are doing pretty well. And so the price point for Sony and, you know, the fact that their install base will have to be people with the PlayStation 4, there's some really interesting pros and cons there. So
MSU Hitman says, ask him if he's had any hands-on time with Fallout. If so, what do you think? If not, are you going to play it?
No, I have not.
Yeah.
Yes, I had the pleasure of getting to work at that Bethesda press conference. The best I got is I saw what you saw 24 hours earlier.
Benefic Rock says, if Adam could adapt any novel to be a video game, what would it be?
Okay, I saw this one. I've been thinking about it. I think the novel I would want to play is something by Joseph Conrad. I mean, probably Lord Jim. Because, you know, especially because it does get really exciting at the end because the evil Captain Brown, he's coming with his bad people and they're going to try to take over. And here's Jim. He's finally made something good in his life, you know, after being a horrible coward earlier on. Yeah. You know, or maybe like a Joseph Conrad open world game where just, you know, you just travel from one bad decision to the next.
Conrad wrote Heart of Darkness, right?
Yeah.
And so Spec Ops, the line is basically Heart of Darkness. So there's another Conrad game.
You're right. I think the thing is, he did Heart of Darkness. He actually does other versions of Heart of Darkness better, like The Secret Sharer and stuff like that. But Lord Jim, which is less, he did, there's two books he wrote that I just love. There's Lord Jim, which is less about, yeah, how evil you can be, but like kind of the dangers of male pride. He did another called The Secret Agent, which is the most viciously funny. It's about an anarchist in London, and he's not very good at being an anarchist, and just these horrible chain of events that he sets in motion. So
cool. The Unsexiest Comedian wants to know, what was the last video game whose choice made you feel the need to take a smoke break? Hashtag G4 podcast. I'm assuming that's a
What game? Oh, that was Heavy Rain. Right, cutting off the finger. I was like, I don't know. I can't go out. I'm going to go outside and think about this. my wife's like, what's up? I was like, I don't know if I should cut off my finger or not. Well, it wasn't Witcher because some of those are timed. But this did happen recently. What was another recent choice game?
Anything from Telltale?
Game of Thrones? I haven't played Telltale lately.
Okay. What are choice based games? Dragon Age?
Yeah, I think it was Dragon Age.
Mm.
And yeah, I can't remember exactly which one, but there's so many characters I loved in that game, and I was like, oh God.
Yeah, why are you making me do this?
Man, you don't know.
Kyle Luden asks, if X-Play would still be around today on G4, do you think you would still be co-hosting?
No. They fired me before the show got canceled.
Joey Ferris says, what was it like doing the Bethesda E3 press show with your former X-Play co-host Morgan Reb?
That was so awesome. There's one other element to it that there's no reason for anyone other than people who worked at G4 to know. Not only was I doing that with Morgan, but the floor director was the floor director for X-Play. And so it was weird. All of a sudden, it felt so normal and familiar.
Yeah.
You know, the one thing that was most important is Morgan and I still had to stand in the same positions because one time they tried to actually mix us up on X-Play and I couldn't read the prompter. It just like, it I have to wrong. Look this direction and she's there. And she had the same feeling. So, I mean, it was so wonderful and comfortable. But then, especially with the floor director, Andy, I had gone out to the back to have a smoke break, which I would do all the time on X-Play. And he came out and goes, Adam, when you're done, they need you back there. And it was exactly what had happened 3 years earlier and for all these years. Yeah. And it really was. It was so much fun to do. And also, it was really fun to do it for Bethesda. They're dear friends. I obviously love their games. Like, the whole thing felt right. That was worth it.
That's awesome. Boss Jug asks, does he miss being in the games press? If not, is there anything he does miss about it?
I don't really miss it. The part I miss the most is what I'm doing right now. Is I got to go into a place of work where there are other people is like absurdly fascinated by the same thing.
Yeah.
And we could just talk about it all the time. Because yeah, my wife does not want to hear it. She's the only other person that's inside my home.
Oh, that's great, honey. Sorry, the Riddler trophies are so annoying.
Ben Parrish wants to know what your favorite sketch or character on X-Play was.
God, there's so many I liked. I know someone brought this up. I had nothing to do with it other than laugh at it, but was Roger the Stanley Experience. There's our good man, Mike Leffler, who played a stand-up comic version of Stan Lee.
Oh,
so
wow.
We called him the Stan Lee Experience because we didn't want to be sued. But nothing about what he said was funny. It was just like him telling horrible stories about screwing over Mike Ditka. And I
oh my God.
All those other guys. But yeah, I think for me personally, I think it's when we did the Vegas. We went out into the desert and we were looking for that. Because that was the first time we took a gamble on doing one of these crazy ass episodes where we spent a lot of money and we blew stuff up. And it really seemed to hit with the audience and it became a definition for the show.
It's great. Deshane, too, wants to know, would you ever write a book about the video game industry? You seem to know a lot and are very well spoken.
Yeah, but I don't think it'd be very interesting. Like, there's no, I mean, if I was to do that much of a tell-all book, you'd be like, man.
That was all you
all
know?
All these people seem to do is work. And I mean, I could probably write one about the ass end of the cable industry, cable television.
Sure.
There actually is a project I've been knocking around. I've been showing to some people, so I'll just leave it at that.
Okay. Yeah, I like that a lot. Matt Clements Jr. says, how is enjoying the quiet, semi-retired life? I imagine him being a gaming by fireplace with a pipe in his mouth type of guy.
Yeah, no.
Yeah.
There's nothing semi-retired about.
Yeah.
Daddy needs to still be bringing home some bacon. I just didn't want to do it from the ways I've been doing it before. It's fun. It's terrifying. Working for yourself is really, I mean, you guys kind of went out on your own.
Yeah.
You know, you don't always know where the next project or the next opportunity is going to be coming from. And then you don't want to have too many things happening all at the same time. Mm-hmm. So you like let them all sort of like spin out and you don't give them the right attention. I'm still struggling to find that perfect balance, but there's some things coming up in the future that might make people happy.
Mm-hmm. Final thing's not a question, just a statement. Confucius90 says, if it's possible, just tell him from me that I love him.
Aww. Yeah. Oh, Confucius. We love you so too. Not friendly.
Ladies and gentlemen, that has been the first and last ever episode 41 of the Kind of Funny Games cast. Thank you so much for your time, Adam.
Oh,
thank
my pleasure.
You for being
thank
here.
You for being here. We appreciate
definitely
you.
Make sure you go check out the Kickstarter for Friday the 13th.
Friday
the
13th.
Game. It looks awesome. I'm really excited to hear more about it.
Me too.
Definitely give it some money if you got money. And if not, just go tell people about it because you can do that for sure. Yeah. Thank you guys for being the coolest dudes in video games.
That's what we do.
Yeah. All right. See y'all next week.
Bye.
Bye.